that would place government monitors in newsrooms to determine how stories were selected, whether there was bias in reporting, and whether critical information needs were being met. If the program had been instituted, the monitors would have been placed not only in broadcast newsrooms, but also print media outlets that the FCC had no regulatory authority over. Even the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, was intentionally abused to deny the press and other groups and individuals access to public information in executive branch departments and agencies, making the functioning of the vast bureaucracy transparent to the public. Politico's Jack Schaefer observed, among other things, that under the Obama administration, the U.S. government has set a new record for withholding Freedom of Information Act requests, according to a recent Associated Press investigation. FOIA gives the public and press an irreplaceable view into the workings of the executive branch. Without timely release of government documents and data, vital questions can't be answered and stories can't be written. No matter. For the vast majority of journalists, Obama's transformative progressive agenda was paramount, and the Democratic Party press was mainly there to help him. Schaefer wrote that at an awards ceremony for excellence in political reporting, Obama was the keynote speaker and praised journalists. Schaefer noted that the last person in the world who should be lecturing journalists on how to do journalism is President Barack Obama. Yet there Obama was, at a journalism awards ceremony, yodeling banalities about the role of a press in a free society, moaning over the dangers posed by he-said-she-said reporting, and, to the delight of the assembled audience, attacking Donald Trump in every way but by name. The press-heavy crowd clapped at Obama's 30-minute address, encouraging his best Trump-baiting lines about free media and the dangers of false equivalence. What they should have done is bombard Obama with rotten fruit, or ripped him with raspberries for his hypocrisy. But they did not. Why? Schaefer, who dislikes Trump, stumbles around the point. That is, the journalists agreed with Obama's politics and policies, just as earlier working reporters agreed with Roosevelt's. Schaefer writes, Obama didn't invent the White House's in-house media shop, which produces videos and other media to disseminate approved news to the public and the press. As long ago as the early 1930s, H.L. Mencken was complaining about how the Roosevelt administration's press agents choked the information pipeline with mimeographed handouts that lazy reporters would then repurpose as news. But Obama's White House has perfected the practice, with a 14-member operation called the White House Office of Digital Strategy that bypasses the press corps with tweets, YouTube videos, Facebook postings, and more. President Trump does not pose a threat to freedom of press, as did certain of his predecessors. Newsrooms and journalists are not imperiled by the current president. There are no known Sedition Act efforts attacking speech and press freedom. No executive orders imprisoning reporters and shuttering newspapers, no FCC actions against broadcast stations, no unprecedented criminal charges against media organizations or reporters, no omnipresent propaganda operations, etc. Nonetheless, the constant media refrain, whether from journalists or editorialists, trying to convince the American people of a demonstrably false narrative— that President Trump has launched an unprecedented battering on freedom of the press, thereby undermining the credibility of the institution of a free press and the First Amendment with the public, is media propaganda and a media-concocted pseudo-event. Unfortunately, too much of what the public reads, hears, and sees from the Democratic Party press fits this description. Chapter 5. News, Propaganda, and pseudo-events. Given the progressive ideology and Democratic Party attachment of most of the modern media and journalists, their commitment to community journalism and social activism, and with the integration of opinion and news-making objective truth increasingly difficult to discern, is the public actually receiving predominantly news, or propaganda, or pseudo-information? One of the keys to answering this question points to Edward Bernays. Bernays, one of his publishers tells us, pioneered the scientific technique of shaping and manipulating public opinion, which he called engineering consent. George Creel enlisted him into President Woodrow Wilson's propaganda operation. Bernays was a nephew of Sigmund Freud and, according to Christopher B. Daly, was a pioneer in theorizing about human thoughts and emotions. Bernays volunteered for the Committee on Public Information and threw himself into the work. His outlook, a mixture of idealism about the cause of spreading democracy and cynicism about the methods involved, was typical of many at the agency. Bernays is considered in some quarters the founder of the contemporary public relations profession. He believed in the power of propaganda and the manipulation and brainwashing of the masses. The minority, that is, masterminds or elites, has discovered a powerful help in influencing majorities. It has been found possible so to mold the mind of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. In the present structure of society, this practice is inevitable. Whatever of social importance is done today, whether in politics, finance, manufacture, agriculture, charity, education, or other fields, must be done with the help of propaganda. Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government. First and foremost, this means using the media, or the media exercising its own ideology-driven will, as a propaganda enterprise. The extent to which propaganda shapes the progress of affairs about us, wrote Bernays, may surprise even well-informed persons. Nevertheless, it is only necessary to look under the surface of the newspaper for a hint as to propaganda's authority over public opinion. Page 1 of the New York Times on the day these paragraphs are written contains 8 important news stories. 4 of them, or one half, are propaganda. The casual reader accepts them as accounts of spontaneous happenings, but are they? Here are the headlines which announce them. 12 nations warn China real reform must come before they give relief. Pritchett reports Zionism will fail. Realty men demand a transit inquiry. And our living standard highest in history, says Hoover Report. How are they propaganda? Bernays writes. Take them in order. The article on China explains the joint report of the Commission on Extraterritoriality in China, presenting an exposition of the powers stand in the Chinese muddle. What it says is less important than what it is. It was made public by the State Department today with the purpose of presenting to the American public a picture of the State Department's position. Its source gives it authority, and the American public tends to accept and support the State Department view. The report of Dr. Pritchett, a trustee of the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace, is an attempt to find the facts about this Jewish colony in the midst of a restless Arab world. When Dr. Pritchett's survey convinced him that in the long run Zionism would bring more bitterness and more unhappiness both for the Jew and for the Arab, this point of view was broadcast with all the authority of the Carnegie Foundation so that the public would hear and believe. The statement by the president of the Real Estate Board of New York and Secretary Hoover's report are similar attempts to influence the public toward an opinion. For Bernays, propaganda was not troubling, but in fact, inevitable and useful. The public was not capable of enlightened thinking and decisions in a republic. Therefore, they need to be led by those who supposedly are, or at least by those who self-servingly claim to be. He explained that these examples are not given to create the impression that there is anything sinister about propaganda. They are set down rather to illustrate how conscious direction is given to events and how the men behind these events influence public opinion. As such, they are examples of modern propaganda. Bernays argues that modern propaganda is a consistent, enduring effort to create or shape events to influence the relations of the public to an enterprise, idea, or group. This practice of creating circumstances and of creating pictures in the minds of millions of persons is very common. Virtually no important undertaking is now carried on without it. According to Bernays, there is a new propaganda which takes account not merely of the individual nor even of the mass mind alone, but also and especially of the anatomy of society with its interlocking group formations and loyalties. It sees the individual not only as a cell in the social organism, but as a cell organized into the social unit. Touch a nerve at a sensitive spot, and you get an automatic response from certain specific members of the organism. There is a despotic odor to Bernays' elevation of propaganda as a righteous yet routine undertaking exercised for virtuous purposes by a supposedly intellectually astute and superior minority. The masses must be shepherded and managed for their own good and the betterment of society. The new propaganda, Bernays explains, having regard to the constitution of society as a whole, not infrequently serves to focus and realize the desires of the masses. Clearly, it is the intelligent minorities which need to make use of propaganda continuously and systematically. In the active proselytizing minorities in whom selfish interests and public interests coincide lie the progress and development of America. Only through the active energy of the intelligent few can the public at large become aware of and act upon new ideas. A modern illustration of Bernays' new propaganda in action was the selling of the Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal. On May 5, 2016, in a long profile piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine, President Barack Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, bragged about his ability and success in deceiving the American people with a complicit press. The article was titled, "The Aspiring Novelist Who Became Obama's Foreign Policy Guru, How Ben Rhodes Rewrote the Rules of Diplomacy for the Digital Age," and was written by David Samuels, who was seemingly both amused by and approving of Rhodes' propaganda techniques. Samuels wrote in part that Rhodes' innovative campaign to sell the Iran deal is likely to be a model for how future administrations explain foreign policy to Congress and the public. The way in which most Americans have heard the story of the Iran deal presented, that the Obama administration began seriously engaging with Iranian officials in 2013 in order to take advantage of a new political reality in Iran, which came about because of elections that brought moderates to power in that country, was largely manufactured for the purpose of selling the deal. A main argument for negotiating with the Iran regime was actively misleading and regurgitated by journalists who wanted to support Obama's policy. As Samuels reported, in the narrative that Rhodes shaped, the story of the Iran deal began in 2013 when a moderate faction inside the Iranian regime, led by Hassan Rouhani, beat regime hardliners in an election and then began to pursue a policy of openness, which included a newfound willingness to negotiate the dismantling of its illicit nuclear weapons program. The president set out the timeline himself in his speech announcing the nuclear deal on July 14, 2015. "Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not." While the president's statement was technically accurate, there had in fact been 2 years of formal negotiations leading up to the signing of the JCPOA. It was also actively misleading because the most meaningful part of the negotiations with Iran had begun in mid-2012, many months before Rouhani and the moderate camp were chosen in an election among candidates hand-picked by Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The idea that there was a new reality in Iran was politically useful to the Obama administration. No doubt Bernays would be impressed with the effectiveness of this propaganda. Indeed, Samuels seemed to find virtue in the Obama administration's successful propaganda campaign. By obtaining broad public currency for the thought that there was a significant split in the regime and that the administration was reaching out to moderate-minded Iranians who wanted peaceful relations with their neighbors and with America, Obama was able to evade what might have otherwise been a divisive but clarifying debate over the actual policy choices that his administration was making. Then came the conga line of experts whose appearances were orchestrated and statements were scripted by Rhodes, who bragged about the ruse. "We created an echo chamber," Rhodes admitted when I asked him to explain the onslaught of freshly minted experts cheerleading for the deal. They were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. Rhodes would also plant the administration's talking points with journalists, some of whom would repeat them verbatim. "In this environment," wrote Samuels, "Rhodes has become adept at ventriloquizing many people at once. Ned Price, Rhodes' assistant, gave me a primer on how it's done. The easiest way for the White House to shape the news," he explained, is from the briefing podiums, each of which has its own dedicated press corps. But then there are sort of these force multipliers, he said, adding, we have our compadres, I will reach out to a couple people, and, you know, I wouldn't want to name them. Media compadres, also known as journalists who were ideological soulmates and willing to report the administration's message as news. Samuels and Price are insiders who know how the propaganda game is played. Samuels replied to Price, I can name them, that is the reporters, I said, ticking off a few names of prominent Washington reporters and columnists who often tweet in sync with White House messaging. Price laughed. I'll say, hey, look, some people are spinning this narrative that this is a sign of American weakness, he continued, but... Samuels, entertained by it all, interrupted. In fact, it's a sign of strength, I said, chuckling. Price continued. And I'll give them some color, and the next thing I know, lots of these guys are in the dot-com publishing space and have huge Twitter followings, and they'll be putting this message out on their own. Bernays' description of the new propaganda is also on display throughout the 24/7 news cycle. Another particularly barefaced example occurred on Sunday, December 30th, 2018, when Chuck Todd, host of NBC's Meet the Press and NBC's political director, issued an on-air proclamation to the nation, followed by a full hour of one-sided propaganda, in which Todd asserted that man-made climate change is a scientific fact, and he would not allow the voices of climate deniers, an offensive term to many as it is coined after the reference to Holocaust deniers, to be heard now or in the future. He stated, This morning we're going to do something that we don't often get to do, dive in on one topic. It's obviously extraordinarily difficult to do this, as the end of this year has proven in the era of Trump. But we're going to take an in-depth look, regardless of that, at a literally earth-changing subject that doesn't get talked about this thoroughly, on television news at least, climate change. But just as important as what we are going to do this hour is what we're not going to do. We're not going to debate climate change, the existence of it. The Earth is getting hotter, and human activity is a major cause, period. We're not going to give time to climate deniers. The science is settled, even if political opinion is not. And we're not going to confuse weather with climate. A heat wave is not more evidence that climate change exists than a blizzard means that it doesn't, unless the blizzard hits Miami. We do have a panel of experts with us today to help us understand the science and consequences of climate change, and yes, ideas to break the political paralysis over it. Todd and his NBC producers and researchers know, as a matter of fact, that there are many legitimate, credentialed, and serious scientists and climate experts who are either skeptical of or outright reject the claims of man-made climate change. Several are academicians, work at think tanks, have produced statistical studies, written significant books, etc. Some question the accuracy of certain research, or the sources of global warming, or whether global warming is occurring, or the role of mankind in global warming, or whether any of this actually matters, or whether a slight increase in warming is actually beneficial to the planet, as it increases plant growth, etc. For example, as the National Association of Scholars writes, S. Fred Singer, a leading scientific skeptic of anthropocentric global warming, AGW, is an atmospheric physicist and founder of the Science and Environmental Policy Project, SEPP, an organization that began challenging the published findings of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, in the 1990s. SEPP established the Leipzig Declaration, a statement of dissent from the 1997 Kyoto Protocol that has been signed by over 100 scientists and meteorologists. Singer established the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change, which in 2009 published Climate Change Reconsidered, an 880-page report on scientific research that contradicts the models of man-made global warming. Singer believes that global warming exists, but that human contributions to it are minimal. In the interview, Singer said he believed his efforts in the last 20 years had been successful in disproving the notion that the science is settled. Chuck Todd dismisses all such experts as deniers and therefore cuts off all intellectual inquiry and discussion about man-made climate change by those who have something worthwhile to contribute to the debate. Patrick Michaels, formerly professor at the University of Virginia and currently director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute, as well as a senior fellow in research and economic development at George Mason University, explains that climate models have done remarkably poorly in replicating the evolution of global temperature during the past several decades, and that high-end climate horror stories emanating from these lousy models are largely unsupported by observations. Further, they manage to ignore a spate of published science demonstrating that the sensitivity of temperature to carbon dioxide changes was substantially overestimated in those models. Richard S. Lindzen is a distinguished senior fellow at Cato's Center for the Study of Science, emeritus professor of meteorology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and previously professor of dynamic meteorology at Harvard University. Lindzen is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and fellow of both the American Meteorological Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He received the Jule G. Charney Award for highly significant research in the atmospheric sciences from the American Meteorological Society and the Distinguished Engineering Achievement Award from the Engineers Council in 2009. Lindzen's pioneering research in atmospheric dynamics has led to his conclusion that the sensitivity of surface temperature to increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide is considerably below that necessary to generate disastrous climate change. Patrick Moore, Greenpeace co-founder and Canadian ecologist, testified before the United States Senate that there is little correlation to support a direct causal relationship between CO2 emissions and rising global temperatures. There is no scientific proof that human emissions of carbon dioxide are the dominant cause of the minor warming of the Earth's atmosphere over the past 100 years. If there were such proof, it would be written down for all to see. No actual proof, as it is understood in science, exists. Moore also criticized the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, for claiming it is extremely likely that human activity is the dominant cause for global warming, noting that extremely likely is not a scientific term. Moore warned the statistics presented by the IPCC are not the result of mathematical calculations or statistical analysis, and may have been invented to support the IPCC's expert judgment. Roy W. Spencer received his Ph.D. in meteorology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1981. Before becoming a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville in 2001, he was a senior scientist for climate studies at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, where he and Dr. John Christie received NASA's Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal for their global temperature monitoring work with satellites. Dr. Spencer's work with NASA continues as the U.S. science team leader for the Advanced Microwave Scanning Radiometer flying on NASA's AQUA satellite. During a presentation at the Heartland Institute's 9th International Conference on Climate Change in Las Vegas, Spencer explained that too many people think that all areas of science are created equal and that scientists objectively look for the answers, but no, there's two kinds of scientists, male and female. Other than that, they're the same as everybody else, and in many instances, in the climate sciences, more biased than your average person. Spencer went on to criticize the temperature data of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, or NOAA, because it has never taken into account the phenomenon of urban heat island effect. Indeed, Spencer pointed to the thermometer-related algorithms as one of the problems in measuring heat. A lot of us still think that a lot of the warming we are seeing in the thermometer record is just urban heat island effect. In fact, Las Vegas, here, even though it's built in the desert basically, in the last 40 years or so, nighttime temperatures here have risen by 10 degrees Fahrenheit because of urbanization. This is an effect that they can't take out of the thermometer record. Their algorithms can't take it out because you can't separate it from global warming. If you've got a long-term warming trend because of urbanization, there's no way NOAA can take out that effect because it's indistinguishable from other temperature readings. In the end, Spencer argues very little is really known about global warming, also known as climate change. After working on global warming for the last 20-plus years, what do we know about it now? The longer you go into the research, you get more questions than you get answers. So, what do we really know about it? Almost nothing. There are many more highly educated and experienced experts who raise a variety of substantive issues and questions about man-made climate change. And henceforth, none of them are welcome on NBC's Meet the Press. Moreover, like NBC, they are not likely to be taken seriously in most newsrooms or by most journalists because they dare to challenge the orthodoxy of the Democratic Party press and the progressive agenda in which solutions to climate change involve new ways of expanding the government's regulatory and taxing role in society via the urgency of climate change and surrendering national sovereignty to international organizations through multi-government agreements. Thus, one-sided opinion is treated as objective truth. Reputable and legitimate individuals who could provide contrary factual information to the public are dismissed as science deniers and climate imposters. And the government and public are urged to engage in immediate political and social activism and demand far-reaching national solutions such as the Green New Deal. NBC and Chuck Todd, among other media outlets and journalists, have interpreted and analyzed the relevant facts through their progressive approach, and their conclusion is final. Period. No doubt Bernays would be proud of Todd, too, for his outstanding effort at manipulating the public and the use of propaganda in the pursuit of his progressive ideological agenda. Indeed, Todd even cited the Trump government's climate report as incontrovertible evidence of global warming, thereby giving the impression of universal validity to Todd's edict. Todd declared that this year a series of climate reports, including one produced by 13 agencies in Mr. Trump's government, issued dire warnings of economic catastrophe if there is not immediate action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the federal response to the climate crisis has been met with political paralysis and denial. Of course, Todd did not mention that the report was produced by holdovers from the Obama administration. Furthermore, the Heartland Institute's H. Sterling Burnett explains in an audit report titled Executive Branch Websites Promoting Global Warming Alarmism and Propaganda that the websites of NASA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Institutes of Health, U.S. Global Change Research Program, and the Departments of Agriculture, Defense, and Energy are continuing to push false claims about climate and environmental issues, including that humans are verifiably causing dangerous climate change. Not only are these agencies failing to accurately describe the active debate concerning the causes and consequences of climate change, they are making normative claims about the past that reflect progressive and liberal value judgments concerning America's development, rather than objective scientific facts about various technological innovations and the contributions they have made toward extending human life and economic development. Given the abundance of experts and research challenging the man-made climate change narrative, who is Todd to throw down the gauntlet and declare the debate over? He does not have any of the background or expertise of the true professionals he dismisses as deniers. He attended college, majored in political science, and did not graduate. While in college, he worked in the presidential campaign of Democratic Senator Tom Harkin. He is 47 years old, with no credentials whatsoever in any of the climate-related sciences. Of course, Todd is not alone among journalists with thin academic records and experiential backgrounds. Then again, propagandizing does not require exceptional knowledge or talent. When looking at media propaganda, it is also necessary to examine its equally deceitful and destructive close companion, pseudo-events, or what President Trump has termed fake news. Among the most prominent to identify and explicate this modus operandi more than half a century ago was Daniel Boorstin, a widely esteemed historian at the University of Chicago and the 12th Librarian of the United States Congress. Writing in 1961, Boorstin observed, "We need not be theologians to see that we have shifted responsibility for making the world interesting from God to the newspaperman. We used to believe there were only so many events in the world. If there were not many intriguing or startling consequences, it was not the fault of the reporter. He could not be expected to report what did not exist. Within the last 100 years, however, and especially in the 20th century, all this has changed. We expect the papers to be full of news. If there is no news visible to the naked eye or to the average citizen, we still expect it to be there for the enterprising newsman. The successful reporter is one who can find a story, even if there is no earthquake or assassination or civil war. If he cannot find a story, then he must make one, by the questions he asks of public figures, by the surprising human interest he unfolds from some commonplace event, or by the news behind the news. If all this fails, then he must give us a think piece, an embroidering of well-known facts or a speculation about startling things to come. This, explained Boorstin, is a new kind of synthetic novelty which has flooded our experience, that being pseudo-events. The common prefix pseudo comes from the Greek word meaning false or intended to deceive. Boorstin explained that with the advent of round-the-clock media, the news gap soon became so narrow that in order to have additional news for each new edition or each new broadcast, it was necessary to plan in advance the stages by which any available news would be unveiled. With more space to fill, the newsman had to fill it ever more quickly. News gathering turned into news making. Moreover, pseudo-events spawn other pseudo-events in geometric progression, writes Boorstin. This is partly because every kind of pseudo-event being planned tends to become ritualized with a protocol and a rigidity all its own. As each type of pseudo-event acquires this rigidity, pressures arise to produce other, derivative forms of pseudo-events which are more fluid, more tantalizing, and more interestingly ambiguous. Nowadays, the test of a Washington reporter is seldom his skill at precise dramatic reporting, but more often his adeptness at dark intimation. If he wishes to keep his news channels open, he must accumulate a vocabulary and develop a style to conceal his sources and obscure the relation of a supposed event or statement to the underlying facts of life, at the same time seeming to offer hard facts. Much of his stock in trade is his own and other people's speculation about the reality of what he reports. He helps create that very obscurity without which the supposed illumination of his reports would be unnecessary. A perfect example of this process involves the so-called Russian collusion allegation, which, to summarize, started as a political accusation leveled against candidate Donald Trump by Hillary Clinton and her campaign, followed by political demands by Democratic members of the Senate and House for the appointment of a special counsel, despite the lack of any criminal prerequisite. The chorus of Democratic Party press outlets and their reporters encouraging such an appointment by promoting the demands, the actual appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel, the countless leaks and speculation about the investigation, the indictments, plea deals, and convictions of individuals unrelated to the original allegation of Russian collusion and President Trump, the various investigative tributaries following from the Mueller investigation, including the subsequent investigation by the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, leading to the Michael Cohen plea deal and claims of campaign violations, and now the multiple congressional investigations. This was followed by news reports speculating about President Trump's legal peril and implications that he would be indicted, that he was already secretly indicted, that his son Donald Jr. would be indicted, that his son-in-law Jared Kushner would be indicted, etc. The point is reached where pseudo-events and the pseudo-news drive the Democratic Party press and the progressive agenda, which certainly includes the removal of President Donald Trump from office as a top priority. In the end, the collusion story turned out to be the biggest pseudo-event and news scam perpetuated against the American people by the Democratic Party press in modern times. The special counsel's report concluded that the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. Notice that the special counsel did not say that prosecutors lacked probable cause to bring charges or that prosecutors did not believe they could secure a conviction given the beyond a reasonable doubt legal standard. The report stated emphatically that collusion could not be established. The special counsel would know. According to Attorney General William Barr, the special counsel employed 19 lawyers who were assisted by a team of approximately 40 FBI agents, intelligence analysts, forensic accountants, and other professional staff. He issued more than 2,800 subpoenas, executed nearly 500 search warrants, obtained more than 230 orders for communication records, issued almost 50 orders authorizing use of pen registers, made 13 requests to foreign governments for evidence, and interviewed approximately 500 witnesses. Consequently, the Democratic Party press narrative that the Trump campaign colluded with the Russian government during the 2016 presidential election was a complete fabrication that consumed 2.5 years of broadcast, print, and internet reporting, 24 hours a day, and involved an untold number of media-inspired and media-promoted conspiracies, plots, allegations, inferences, suppositions, and conclusions. On March 25, 2019, Newsbusters' Rich Noyes confirmed the extent of the media's saturation bombing of the public with false information about this pseudo-event with these incredible statistics. From January 20, 2017, Inauguration Day, through March 21, 2019, the last night before Special Counsel Robert Mueller sent his report to the Attorney General, the ABC, CBS, and NBC evening newscasts produced a combined 2,284 minutes of collusion coverage, most of it, 1,909 minutes, following Mueller's appointment on May 17, 2017. It's an average of roughly 3 minutes a night every night for an astonishing 791 days. From January 1st through March 21st of this year, the spin of Trump coverage on the evening newscast has been 92% negative versus just 8% positive. Among the news organizations with some of the most spectacularly irresponsible reporting were the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of which won a Pulitzer Prize for scoops on links between Donald Trump's presidential campaign and Russia, the focus of an ongoing special counsel investigation into the 2016 election. New York Times executive editor Dean P. Baquet was proud of his newspaper's journalism, even after the special counsel concluded that there was no collusion. "We wrote a lot about Russia, and I have no regrets. It's not our job to determine whether or not there was illegality. However, the issue is not about illegality, but the obsessive promotion and perpetuation of a pseudo-event as real news." CNN was among the most rabid collusion hunters in the news industry. On March 26, 2019, Breitbart's Joshua Kaplan reported, "Last December, CNN congressional correspondent Manu Raju reported that WikiLeaks emailed Donald Trump Jr. access to information nearly 2 weeks prior to their public release. However, the network failed to verify the email's date, September 14, 2016, by which time the emails had already been released. In June, CNN reported that White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci was being investigated for meeting with a Russian banker ahead of President Trump's inauguration. Scaramucci denied the claim, and CNN eventually apologized for its inaccurate report. CNN executive editor Lex Harris, editor Eric Lichblau, and journalist Thomas Frank resigned in shame over the story. Further, CNN claimed in July that Michael Cohen, President Trump's personal lawyer, was prepared to tell special counsel investigators that the president possessed advanced knowledge of the Trump Tower meeting between his son, Donald Trump Jr., and a Russian lawyer and others. Cohen's lawyer, Lanny Davis, later said CNN had mixed up its facts and denied claims that Cohen had any such knowledge about the meeting. Nonetheless, CNN's president, Jeffrey Zucker, self-righteously declared, "We are not investigators, we are journalists, and our role is to report the facts as we know them," which is exactly what we did. A sitting president's own Justice Department investigated his campaign for collusion with a hostile nation. That's not enormous because the media says so. That's enormous because it's unprecedented. But CNN repeatedly reported not facts, but fiction. Indeed, the media wagons began to circle again as a growing number of media executives, journalists, and commentators shamelessly pushed back against their critics. For example, on March 25, 2019, while appearing on The View, ABC News chief White House correspondent John Carl asserted that, "I think there are some questions that need to be asked. I think there were significant mistakes in some of the reporting, but I also think this is a huge story. This is the most significant investigation of a president since Watergate. The allegations couldn't have been more high stakes. The idea of a foreign power potentially colluding with a presidential candidate? Now, it turned out that was not the case, but there were significant steps along the way. There was a major criminal investigation here. How could reporters not cover that and cover it aggressively and consistently? Perhaps the best answer was provided by Fox News senior political analyst and former ABC News chief White House correspondent Britt Hume. On March 25, 2019, during an appearance on Fox, Hume declared, "If you think about it, this investigation actually goes back to about the middle of 2016, so it's been going on for quite a long time, and this endless speculation about it and indeed the accusations about it that came out of many mouths on cable television and in the public prints, the list of people who got it wrong, is really quite extensive. And, you know, to include many news organizations that got the prospect of Donald Trump being elected in the first place badly wrong and seemed not to learn very much from that. One hopes and expects, perhaps, that after this debacle, and that's exactly what it is, in the worst journalistic debacle of my lifetime, that there will be some serious soul-searching. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing a lot of it. I noticed that a couple of our cable news competitors have moved on kind of seamlessly on to speculation about obstruction of justice now, following, as they so often seem to do, the Democratic Party script. Having learned nothing and not interested in changing course, the Democratic Party press looks for new opportunities to create pseudo-events, as one event spawns another event. Again, as Boorstin stated, these events become ritualized with a protocol and rigidity all their own. Indeed, the media turned to questioning Attorney General Barr's motives, running stories based on anonymous sources about dissension on the special counsel's staff, treating a PR stunt, a legally baseless subpoena issued by House Democrats for an unredacted copy of the Mueller report, as breaking news, etc. More broadly, the media inundate the public with news stories based on claims, speculation, and spin from anonymous sources or unattributed sources or leaks that typically support and promote their narrative. Nearly entire books critical of the president and his management style, including by investigative journalist Bob Woodward, rely heavily on anonymous sources. Frequently, the books and their authors are themselves treated as newsworthy and receive considerable subsequent news coverage. Meanwhile, the public is unable to rationally judge the authenticity of these reports and books because they are unable to take the measure of those who are supposedly providing the information to the journalists and authors and whether they are reliable, disgruntled, or have an axe to grind, etc. In fact, on September 5, 2018, the New York Times published an opinion piece authored by Anonymous titled, "I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration. I work for the president, but like-minded colleagues and I have vowed to thwart part of his agenda and his worst inclinations." The Times explained its extraordinary decision, stating, "The Times is taking the rare step of publishing an anonymous op-ed essay. We have done so at the request of the author, a senior official in the Trump administration whose identity is known to us and whose job would be jeopardized by its disclosure. We believe publishing this essay anonymously is the only way to deliver an important perspective to our readers." Here is a sample of the anonymous author's assertions. "The dilemma, which the president does not fully grasp, is that many of the senior officials in his own administration are working diligently from within to frustrate parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations. But we believe our first duty is to this country, and the president continues to act in a manner that is detrimental to the health of our republic. The root of the problem is the president's amorality. Anyone who works with him knows he is not moored to any discernible first principles that guide his decision-making. Given the instability many witnessed, there were early whispers within the cabinet of invoking the 25th Amendment, which would start a complex process for removing the president. But no one wanted to precipitate a constitutional crisis. So we will do what we can to steer the administration in the right direction until, one way or another, it's over. The bigger concern is not what Mr. Trump has done to the presidency, but rather what we as a nation have allowed him to do to us. We have sunk low with him and allowed our discourse to be stripped of civility." From the moment the Times published the op-ed and for weeks thereafter, this single individual's unsigned opinion essay, disputed on the substance and on the record by several current and former Trump White House officials, was the subject of extravagant Bang news coverage. This is exactly what the Times editors had hoped for, and the rest of the Democratic Party press was more than happy to oblige. A pseudo-event gone wild. Boorstin described another pseudo-event spectacle, the making of the newsman's public persona. At first it may seem strange that the rise of pseudo-events has coincided with the growth of the professional ethic, which obliges newsmen to omit editorializing and personal judgments from their news accounts. But now it is in the making of pseudo-events that newsmen find ample scope for their individuality and creative imagination. CNN's chief White House correspondent Jim Acosta fits this characterization well. On November 7, 2018, the nation witnessed Acosta's attempt to hijack the presidential press conference and use his position in the press to argue with President Trump about the thousands of illegal aliens headed in an organized march to the southern U.S. border. Acosta did not ask actual questions. He made assertions in the form of questions, and he did so repeatedly, refusing to give up the microphone. He was rude to the president and his press colleagues. Moreover, when arguing with the president, he was wrong on essential facts. At the outset, Acosta provocatively confronted the president. "I wanted to challenge you on one of the statements that you made in the tail end of the campaign in the midterms that..." President Barack Obama was never addressed this way by the Democratic Party press at any of his presidential press conferences. In fact, there is no reason for any journalist to behave this way with a president during a press conference. Just ask the question respectfully. Acosta then essentially accused the president of lying and race-baiting. Acosta: "That this caravan was an invasion, as you know, Mr. President." Trump: "I consider it to be an invasion." Acosta: "As you know, Mr. President, the caravan was not an invasion. It's a group of migrants moving up from Central America towards the border with the U.S. and..." Trump: "Thank you for telling me that. I appreciate it." Acosta: "Why did you characterize it as such?" Trump: "Because I consider it an invasion. You and I have a difference of opinion." Acosta: "But do you think that you demonized immigrants in this election to try to keep..." At the time, Acosta had not covered in person the illegal alien march to the border. Their arrival later in Tijuana and the turmoil that transpired there. Nor did he investigate the organizations and funding sources for the march. Acosta knew no more than the public and less than those who had actually done real reporting. Nor did Acosta have the information provided to the presidents on a daily basis by the Department of Homeland Security. By his insolent and theatrical conduct at this presidential press conference, which is consistent with his conduct at most press conferences, he created a pseudo-event starring himself, which neither informed nor benefited the public, but resulted in subsequent pseudo-events when his press pass was pulled by the White House and CNN went to court to retrieve it with the support of most of the other media. Moreover, recent events on the border with unprecedented numbers of migrants pouring into the United States, overwhelming law enforcement, administrative courts, and detention centers underscores just how wrong Acosta was. Acosta's antics have also made him a favorite on the late-night show circuit, where he is treated like a Hollywood celebrity. Acosta then secured a book deal with HarperCollins Publishers. He was paid to dish on the president and his staff collecting information and writing notes for his book while reporting on the White House for CNN. Is there any doubt that Acosta's confrontations and tone with the president and his staff were, at least in part, premeditated for the purpose of providing fodder for his book? Is that how news reporting is supposed to work? How does this benefit or serve the American people? The Acosta book's title is The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. According to the publisher's press release, it provides never-before-revealed stories of his White House's rejection of truth while laying out the stakes for how Trump's hostility toward facts poses an unprecedented threat to our democracy. In further hype for Acosta's book, the press release exclaimed, "The president and his team, not to mention some of his supporters, have attempted to silence the press in ways we have never seen before. As just about everybody has seen, I witnessed this firsthand. As difficult as that challenge may be for the free press in America, we must continue to do our jobs and report the news. The truth is worth the fight. Acosta is illustrative of a media mentality filled with self-promotion and near-hysterical claims and spin intended to draw attention to oneself, to highlight a particular event or agenda, and to make news. Even the press release is laced with propaganda and preposterous allegations, including Acosta's self-aggrandizing assertion that there have been unprecedented attempts by the Trump administration to silence the press. See Chapter 4, which addresses such propaganda. What, therefore, have the modern media and present-day journalists created? Boorstin argued that having discarded the journalism of objective truth in a democratic society like ours, and more especially in a highly literate, wealthy, competitive, and technologically advanced society, the people can be flooded by pseudo-events. For us, freedom of speech and of the press and of broadcasting includes freedom to create pseudo-events. Competing politicians, competing newsmen, and competing news media contend in this creation. They vie with one another in offering attractive, informative accounts and images of the world. They are free to speculate on facts, to bring new facts into being, to demand answers to their own contrived questions. Our free marketplace of ideas is a place where people are confronted by competing pseudo-events and are allowed to judge among them. When we speak of informing the people, this is what we really mean. Consequently, Boorstin maintained we spend much of our waking hours living in a world of unreality fashioned by, among others, the press. The American citizen thus lives in a world where fantasy is more real than reality, where the image has more dignity than its original. We hardly dare face our bewilderment because our ambiguous experience is so pleasantly iridescent, and the solace of belief in contrived reality is so thoroughly real. We have become eager accessories to the great hoaxes of the age. These are the hoaxes we play on ourselves. Boorstin astutely advised, "What ails us most is not what we have done with America, but what we have substituted for America. We suffer primarily not from our vices or weaknesses, but from our illusions. We are haunted not by reality, but by those images we have put in place of reality. To discover our illusion will not solve the problems of our world, but if we do not discover them, we will never discover our real problems. To dispel the ghosts which populate the world of our making will not give us the power to conquer the real enemies of the real world, or to remake the real world. But it may help us discover that we cannot make the world in our image. It will liberate us and sharpen our vision. It will clear away the fog so we can face the world we share with all mankind." Good advice, but is there any indication that the Democratic Party press will accept it? Not yet. They continue on a destructive course. Indeed, when their reporting is challenged, these same media groups and reporters respond to criticism by insisting it is they who are the guardians of freedom of the press. "That was once an institution preserved in the interest of the community," wrote Boorstin. "Now it is often a euphemism for the prerogative of reporters to produce their synthetic commodity." In addition to the routine use of propaganda and the dissemination of pseudo-events, the media also engage in another form of manipulation. Self-censorship and outright suppression of information or events to advance a narrative or kill actual news. Two particularly hideous examples of this dishonest practice involve the real-time evidence in the 1930s and 1940s of the Nazis' liquidation of Europe's Jews and in the early 1930s of the Stalin regime's starvation of the Ukrainians. As hard as it may be to believe, most of the American press, led by the New York Times, consciously downplayed or ignored the Holocaust and the Holodomor. Therefore, for some time, most Americans were oblivious to what was taking place. Chapter 6. The New York Times Betrays Millions. British journalist Claude Coburn once wrote, "All stories are written backwards. They are supposed to begin with the facts and develop from there, but in reality, they begin with a journalist's point of view, a conception, and it is the point of view from which the facts are subsequently organized." And so it was when it came to reporting about the Holocaust, where, among other things, journalistic groupthink and other professional malpractices, suppression and outright self-censorship, came together to create a monumental betrayal of millions of European Jews and the American public in what was the greatest example of American media recklessness and deceit ever perpetrated by the press. In 1984, Dr. David S. Wyman, in his book The Abandonment of the Jews, explained that one reason ordinary Americans were not more responsive to the plight of European Jews during the Holocaust was that very many, probably a majority, were unaware of Hitler's extermination program until well into 1944 or later. The information was not readily available to the public because the mass media treated the systematic murder of millions of Jews as though it were minor news. Yet on November 24, 1942, unambiguous evidence of the Nazis' ongoing extermination of European Jews was made publicly available, but was largely ignored by the media. Lack of solid press coverage in the weeks immediately following November 24th muffled the historic news at the outset. In fact, newly released documents prove that the Allied powers knew firsthand of the mass murder of Jews by December 1942. As first reported on April 18, 2017 by The Independent, a British newspaper, newly accessed material from the United Nations, not seen for around 70 years, shows that as early as December 1942, the US, UK, and Soviet governments were aware that at least 2 million Jews had been murdered and a further 5 million were at risk of being killed and were preparing charges. Despite this, the Allied powers did very little to try and rescue or provide sanctuary to those in mortal danger. In late December 1942, UK Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden told the British Parliament, the German authorities, not content with denying to persons of Jewish race in all the territories over which their barbarous rule extends the most elementary human rights, are now carrying into effect Hitler's oft-repeated intention to exterminate the Jewish people. In the United States, Wyman asserted, two or three clear statements from Franklin Roosevelt would have moved this news into public view and kept it there for some time. But the president was not so inclined, nor did Washington reporters press him. In retrospect, it seems almost unbelievable that in Roosevelt's press conferences, normally held twice a week, not one word was spoken about the mass killing of European Jews until almost a year later. The president had nothing to say to reporters on the matter, and no correspondent asked him about it. Roosevelt and his State Department, which was populated with several individuals who were at a minimum indifferent to the fate of the European Jews, and others who were flat-out anti-Semites, did not want to draw attention to the Holocaust. Roosevelt was assisted in this policy by the American press. For most of the war, news outlets and journalists censored information about the ongoing extermination of Jews, or hid the information in infrequent and sporadic reports among voluminous other news stories. Most newspapers printed very little about the Holocaust, wrote Wyman, even though extensive information on it eventually reached their desks from news services, AP, UP, and others, and from their own correspondents. Surely the New York Times, with its wide reach, resources, access to foreign sources of information, reputation as the foremost newspaper in the country, large Jewish readership and its Jewish ownership, would do everything possible to investigate and disclose the horrors of Jewish genocide. But the opposite was true. Wyman explained that the Times, Jewish-owned but anxious not to be seen as Jewish-oriented, was the premier American newspaper of the era. It printed a substantial amount of information on Holocaust-related events, but almost always buried it on the inner pages. And the Washington Post? The Jewish-owned Washington Post printed a few editorials advocating rescue, but only infrequently carried news reports on the European Jewish situation. The other Washington newspapers provided similarly limited information on the mass murder of European Jewry. And most of the other press? Outside New York and Washington, press coverage was even thinner. All major newspapers carried some Holocaust-related news, but it appeared infrequently and almost always in small items located on inside pages. American mass circulation magazines all but ignored the Holocaust. Radio coverage of Holocaust news was sparse. Emory University professor Deborah E. Lipstadt, in her book Beyond Belief, saw the media's self-censorship during the Holocaust as a broadly institutional problem. She wrote that the press bears a great measure of responsibility for the public's skepticism and ignorance of the scope of the wartime tragedy, the Nazi mass murder of Jews. The public's doubts were strengthened and possibly even created by the manner in which the media told the story. If the press did not help plant the seeds of doubt in readers' minds, it did little to eradicate them. During the war, journalists frequently said that the news of deportations and executions did not come from eyewitnesses who could personally confirm what had happened, and they, as journalists, were obliged to treat it skeptically. This explanation is faulty because much of the information came from German statements, broadcasts, and newspapers. If anything, these sources would have been inclined to deny, not verify, the news. Neutral sources also affirmed the reliability of reports. Moreover, even when the press did encounter witnesses, it often dismissed what they had to say because they were not considered reliable or impartial. Certainly by 1943, and we now know by 1942, wrote Lipstadt, the Nazi threat to exterminate the Jews should have been understood as a literal one. There was little reason, in light of the abundance of evidence, to deny that multitudes were being murdered as part of a planned program of annihilation. But despite all the details, there was a feeling among some correspondents, New York Times reporter Bill Lawrence, most prominent among them, that the reports that Hitler and his followers had conducted a systematic extermination campaign were untrue. Lawrence did not doubt that Hitler had treated the Jews badly, forcing many of them to flee to the sanctuaries of the West, but even in October 1943, 10 months after the Allied declaration confirming the Nazi policy of exterminating the Jews, he could not believe that the Nazis had murdered millions of Jews, Slavs, Gypsies, and those who might be mentally retarded. Lipstadt's research also found that for much of the war, the Roosevelt administration whitewashed or de-emphasized the Nazi eradication of Jews, and the mass media were compliant, regurgitating the government's propaganda or suppressing the evidence. Lipstadt explained that the Office of War Information, working in tandem with the Roosevelt administration, tried to severely limit any public attention paid to the mass murder of the Jews. Despite the fact that the final solution was the prime illustration of the enemy's strategy and principles, the Office of War Information wanted it to be avoided by news agencies and not mentioned in war propaganda. The press mirrored the official policy of omitting mention of Jews or incorporating them into the general suffering faced by many other national groups. When Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, and Joseph Stalin issued a formal declaration condemning Nazi atrocities, they were calculatedly silent about the active eradication of the Jews. Lipstadt emphasized, "Probably the most outrageous example of this explicit policy of ignoring the Jewish aspect of the tragedy occurred in Moscow in the fall of 1943. There, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin met and affixed their signature to what is known as the Moscow Declaration, which warned, Germans who take part in the wholesale shooting of Italian officers or in the execution of French, Dutch, Belgian, or Norwegian hostages or of the Cretan peasants or who have shared in slaughters inflicted on the people of Poland or in the territories of the Soviet Union will be brought back to the scene of their crimes and judged on the spot by the peoples whom they have outraged. Nowhere in the declaration were the Jews even obliquely mentioned, Lipstadt noted, a phenomenon the press simply ignored. Shockingly, the media's cover-up continued nearly up to the war's conclusion. Lipstadt wrote that even when the war had virtually ended and the death camps were being liberated, reporters continued to incorporate the fate of the Jews into that of all other national groups that had been incarcerated and murdered at the camps for the purpose of minimizing the targeted atrocities against the Jews and Hitler's final solution. Taking direct aim at the New York Times, Professor Laurel Leff of Northeastern University, formerly a journalist, meticulously scrutinized not only the role of the media generally during the Holocaust, but the Times in particular. She has written extensively about how the New York Times failed in its coverage of the fate of European Jews from 1939 to 1945. In her book, Buried by the Times, she asks, what was it about prevailing press standards and the policies and personalities at the Times that led the nation's most important newspaper to discount one of the century's most important news stories? The Times was unique in the comprehensiveness of its coverage and the extent of its influence among American opinion makers, Because of its long-time commitment to international affairs and its willingness to sacrifice advertising rather than articles in the face of a newsprint crunch, and its substantial Jewish readership, the Times was able to obtain and publish more news than any other mainstream newspaper. The way the Times published that news also had a disproportionate impact on both policymakers and fellow journalists who considered it the newspaper of record. That the Times was owned by Jews of German ancestry, who would seemingly be more sensitive to the plight of their European brethren, further magnified the Times' critical role in shaping contemporaneous coverage of the Holocaust. Leff then makes this damning disclosure. The Times' judgment that the murder of millions of Jews was a relatively unimportant story reverberated among other journalists trying to assess the news, among Jewish groups trying to arouse public opinion, and among government leaders trying to decide on an American response. The Times publisher Arthur Hayes Sulzberger intentionally and repeatedly buried news about the Holocaust deep within his paper, or ignored it altogether. Leff writes, "Although the war was the dominant news, it need not have been, and was not, the only front-page news. The New York Times printed between 12 and 15 front-page stories every day. Fewer than half of these typically concerned the war. The Times' first story on the Nazi extermination campaign, which described it as the greatest mass slaughter in history, appeared on page 5, tacked onto the bottom of a column of stories. Yet the deaths of other civilians, often fewer than 100, regularly appeared on the front page." Sulzberger's personal philosophical views of Judaism also played a major part in his callous disengagement from the plight of the European Jews. "In the case of Sulzberger," writes Leff, "concerns about special pleading and dual loyalties were not purely a pragmatic calculation. They also reflected a deeply felt religious and philosophical belief that made Sulzberger resistant to changing his views in the light of changing circumstances. Being Jewish was solely a religious, not a racial or ethnic orientation," he maintained, "that carried with it no